You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, that are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a Collected Works, Volume 181 by Dr. Rudolf Steiner. Main title is Dying Earth and Living Cosmos, actually composed of three different lecture cycles. On the last one, I think this is lecture four in the set of seven of this last set, which is entitled The Need for New Forms of Consciousness. This is lecture 18, given in Berlin on the 16th of July, 1918, translated by Matthew Barton. I would like to continue the observations I began regarding the passage of the human soul through its diverse lives on Earth in our current cycle of humanity, and to do so in a way which can shed some light on current events of immediate concern. With this in mind, I want to develop a theme today that is more concerned with outward occurrences, and then, in a week's time, take this theme in a more inward direction. In its passage through successive lives on Earth, we have described how the human soul as self learns and experiences something new in each incarnation. We will focus today on three periods in particular, the Egyptian Chaldean, the Greco-Roman period, and our own times. Let us also remember how things will be for souls today in our time who pass through their earthly incarnation and are then reborn after a comparatively normal period of time. While not true for all, this applies to a very great number. I have repeatedly said, and did so again last time, that souls now in earthly incarnation will largely return with some form of sure inner knowledge, and I described this form more precisely last time, of successive incarnations. The future age will see this important new development in which souls pass from their current uncertainty about successive lives on Earth to knowledge of this. As I said, we looked at this more precisely last time. However, there is something else I wish to emphasize. I drew your attention to the importance of the period starting roughly with the 8th or 7th centuries B.C. During the first few centuries of this time span, a comparatively large number of souls were still able to look back to their former incarnations because of habits of ancient clairvoyance they retained. But having especially developed the sentient soul in these former lives, as they looked back, they saw how they conducted themselves in the external world. They acquired something like a tangible picture of how a person walked around in the physical world and what outwardly happened to him. But this is something that souls will not have in the forthcoming era, reckoned from today. As they look back, their gaze will no longer be focused on sentient experience, on how a person walks about in physical space and what happens to him there. This recall will have less of a vividly real content in the sensory meaning, but instead a greater apprehension of soul nature. I mention this again here so that you can see that in their successive lives, souls undergo very diverse experiences. And one can really wonder why historians and the public at large think that human nature has changed so little over the ages. Ordinary historians, and most of them, though not all, are well-meaning, invariably look back to a certain point when historical records began, and over this period the human soul is thought to have been configured in more or less the same way. A certain development is accepted, but scarcely radical in nature, and far less incisive than the account we draw from spiritual scientific research. How can it be that people have so little sense of the transformations undergone by the human soul. This certainly seems problematic. If we now consider historical events from the perspective of spiritual science, we find that for a long time now, human beings have been held back from self-knowledge, from a knowledge of their own soul, rather than being led toward such knowledge. We can really only understand and perceive how the human soul changes from incarnation to incarnation if authentic self-knowledge comes into its own. And yet the events we will now reflect on have suppressed it to a very great degree. It is possible to cite significant instances of how self-knowledge has been suppressed in recent history. A certain fraternity you are well aware of, the Freemasons, no doubt believes, along with many of its well-meaning members, that it is helping those in its ranks toward self-knowledge. This fraternity has diverse symbols which spiritual scientific insights can tell us are profound and deeply meaningful, and would all be well suited to lead people toward self-knowledge. But this does not happen. It is very curious. If you read the official histories of the Freemason movement, the more enlightened of them suggest it is necessary to go back only to the 17th or 18th centuries to acquaint oneself with modern Freemasonry. And yet the inner content of the Freemason symbols was in fact concealed from the 17th century onward, transformed into something Freemasons regard, engage with, and yet have ever less need to understand. If one were to investigate Freemason symbolism with a greater understanding of its meaning, this would certainly offer a path toward human self-knowledge, since the symbols themselves have this potential. But actual developments took a different course, seeking to smother self-knowledge, render it impossible by a focus on merely outward symbols. A truthful view of what has happened here will discern that modern Freemasonry has developed basically with a view to rendering incomprehensible the symbols at the center of this fraternity. It almost seems as if there were an unconscious plan, an intention to render these symbols incomprehensible because human beings were seized with a fear of self-knowledge as modern Freemasonry was developing, amongst the enlightened Freemasons, not the mystical ones. There is a great deal of talk about self-knowledge, about the need for a human being to seek his higher divine self and so forth. But it is all just talk, and in fact serves the purpose largely of obstructing rather than smoothing the path to self-knowledge. Where does this disinclination or fear of self-knowledge originate? Today I will explore this, firstly, from a more external point of view. It is, of course, not just here in Freemasonry that this anxiety is apparent, but throughout our modern culture. It is a curious thing to realize that this modern culture of ours, especially wherever Christianity has spread, actually pursues efforts to conceal and suppress self-knowledge. This is extremely interesting and highly significant. Very few people make the effort nowadays to compare the beliefs they hold with better accounts from more distant times, nor to reflect on the nature of things that surface within them. If you study Hermann Grimm's book on the life of Michelangelo, you can do a rather interesting little inner experiment with it. Grimm has really written more about the age in which Michelangelo lived, from which he emerged. But try, with the aid of this book, to picture what the world around you would be like if you could walk around at that time of Michelangelo. Then see if you can compare this world with the one in which you now live. There is really a huge difference. This does not necessarily mean very much in itself, since it is not so very long ago, really, since Michelangelo's day. Something else emerges, however, if we now really focus our attention on the era with its antecedents and after effects, when the radical turning point of modern times occurred. If we look back to the three great periods which spiritual science describes for our current earth cycle, the third epoch closes around the 8th or 7th century BC, while the fourth epoch concludes at the beginning of the 15th century. Here at the start of the 15th century, which is not so long ago, we can discern a radical change, a new departure in the soul experience of modern people. History rarely detects this or describes it. Why does it not? Precisely because of this fear of self-knowledge, of insight into the life of the human soul. If you were to read accounts of an individual, such as Bernard of Clairvaux, you would find something very interesting. Bernard, perhaps the most important figure of the 12th century, of the era which concludes the fourth post-Atlantean cultural epoch, reveals a configuration of soul that simply became impossible in Europe after the 15th century. Today it is extremely difficult to reimagine the soul life of such a person, since all the foundations for this are now lacking. But I recommend reading biographies of Bernard so that you can see how others at the time were struck by his inner life. In reading these accounts of his life, you can feel that they surpass the stories of miracles in the Gospels. The few sick people whom Christ Jesus himself heals in the Gospel accounts appear as nothing compared to the wonders accomplished by Bernard almost 12 centuries later, news of which spread far and wide. He apparently heals far more people, giving eyesight back to the blind and making the lame walk again. And accounts of the sermons given by Bernard are so powerful that one gains the sense of a great spiritual aura emanating from his words, a reality of which we can form very little idea now, living in the words of this man. If one were to try to describe all that issued from him, it would meet with disbelief, since nothing in our own time enables us to form a picture of the impression made by such a figure as Saint Bernard. Even in these circles, we lack the real basis for entering into the inner configuration of Bernard's soul. But I would still like to emphasize one thing. In this individual lived an utter devotion to the world of spirit, with which he merged completely. Nowadays, it seems perfectly natural to us, if we undertake to do something, but without success, to ask ourselves whether what we envisaged was right after all. Someone like Saint Bernard never doubts, for whatever he undertakes or advises others to do, he has invariably talked of beforehand with his God in the world of spirit. And even in misadventures such as those he experienced during the Crusades, when everything he advised had failed, he never for a moment doubted that his thoughts were completely right, and that the discrepancy between what happened in the outer reality of the sensory world and what he conceived by the guidance of the world of spirit is something that will in some way eventually be resolved. Bernard is a striking figure in this respect. But although he was of outstanding stature, what I have said about him is not by any means confined to one individual, but is a signature of that whole era. It is the signature of that particular era in Europe, starting around the 3rd and 4th centuries AD, and lasting until the 13th, 14th, and 15th centuries. Naturally, other things are in preparation during this period, but they only come to the fore and really become determining characteristics of the times after the 14th or 15th centuries. Between the 3rd and 15th century was a time when the power of faith grew ever stronger, was increasingly consolidated, and became a determining influence on events. Please note here that I use words very carefully and with intent, something generally so in my lectures. If one were to substitute other words for the ones I have used, it would no longer be historically accurate. If, instead of speaking of the consolidating power of faith, one used the term consolidating piety, this would be quite wrong. That is not what I mean. It was the power of faith that lived in Bernard. Certainly he was a pious man. But that is something one can also be as a person, in personal terms. Events in the centuries I am speaking of were informed, rather, by the power of faith living in and at work in them. The power of faith exists in every age, but is not always historically decisive, as it was then. Our own age will be followed by another, when, albeit temporarily and sporadically, the power of faith will once again play a certain role. This is not yet true today. In future, for instance, the superstitions prevalent in modern materialistic medicine will assume grotesque forms. The power of faith will play a great part then, but things have not yet advanced so far. At present, we can witness more of a twilight sleep amongst humanity, and this plays an incisive part in current historical events. But now we can ask this question: why or how was it that this power of faith became such a significant historical impulse in Europe, leading up to and introducing the fifth post-Atlantean epoch in which we now live? Firstly, something very external provided the basis for this power of faith to develop, the same that largely brought about the fall of the Roman Empire. Historical impulses at work from the 3rd and 4th centuries through to the 15th replaced the impulses driving the Roman Empire. Naturally, the decline and fall of the Roman Empire was caused by several factors, but one of these was the fact that money had gradually drained eastward to the Orient during the course of Roman history. As the Roman Empire expanded, the legions were drawn ever further to its distant boundaries, and soldiers' wages increasingly had to be paid in money rather than payments in kind, as had been possible in a less extensive empire. Monetary wealth had actually passed to the Orient, along with the extending empire. And Europe in the early Christian centuries, from the 3rd and 4th centuries, is characterized by its lack of money, its paucity of metal coinage. Various other things are connected with this, and it is important to keep one's feet on the ground when studying them, rather than indulging in mystical fantasies. We should keep a sober eye on reality. The art of alchemy, with its efforts to create gold, partly arose in Europe because all the money had drained away to the Orient. People thought they could make gold, create it instead, and regain wealth by this means. Underlying alchemy, as this developed in the early Middle Ages, is paucity of money, caused by the Roman Empire's expansion. And to this is due in turn the influx of northern tribes into the impoverished Roman Empire, with their heathen culture, sentiments, and outlooks, and little understanding of the strong social structures that had become ever more substantial under the influence of money. The Romans felt extremely uncomfortable about the loss of their monetary wealth toward the Orient, whereas invading Germanic tribes were perfectly happy with the situation. The spread of Christianity came as this mood emerged in the Roman Empire. People are no longer aware of this, but in fact a profound spiritual outlook was born upon the spreading waves of Christianity in these times of its early development. In theological circles especially, there is still an irrational fear of what is called gnosis. If you ask people in theological circles why they dislike our spiritual science, or even fear it, they will often tell you that it could lead to a renewal or revival of gnosis, and this in itself is a reason to reject it. Although gnosis must surface in a different form, of course, from the one it had in the early Christian centuries, It is in reality nothing other than a positive knowledge of the world of spirit, a human capacity to gain insight into spiritual worlds, just as one comes to understand physical worlds through the physical senses. You often meet people who mock all the disputes that once existed about, say, whether the Spirit issues from the Father or the Son, or is in some other way connected with these. People cannot make head or tail of such arguments nowadays, but in those times these ideas meant something. To write a true history of the early Christian centuries, you would need to know that there is meaning and spirit at the source of these dogmas, although people can no longer discover this. Born on the waves of spreading Christianity was a profoundly significant spiritual apprehension which extends through into the 9th century. If you study the details of this expanding Christianity, you can find that the later view that religious sensibility should be restricted to pervading oneself with the power of faith, without engaging with diverse aspects of the world of spirit, arose from a correct perception of the nature of the tribes from which the new Europe emerged. These heathen people had not got very far in their thinking, in the association and development of concepts that embraced the world of spirit. They were vigorous, powerful, primordially healthy people, but they did not have the mental faculties to form very tangible ideas about anything spiritual. Those who supported the spread of Christianity adapted to these tribes and their ways in order to do so. But because these people had a less developed thinking capacity, an appeal was made instead to their power of faith. And so we see how in the 10th century all spirit vision has more or less faded from Christianity and been compressed instead into the power of faith. The vision vouchsafed by this power of faith, the support felt to be offered by it, gradually became the inner content of people's souls. Souls lived differently then from now. You have to picture the experience a person of those days had in response to a legend. Let me tell you a simple legend that was widespread at the time. It runs as follows. Saint Bernard was once riding upon a donkey and had a monk with him who, as one would say today, suffered from epilepsy. The monk kept falling over as he was leading the donkey. Bernard turned to God to ask him that henceforth the monk should never suffer from epilepsy again without knowing this in advance. The legend goes on to say that the monk lived another 20 years, and whenever he was to have an attack of epilepsy, he knew of it beforehand and would lie down in bed so that no harm came to him as he fell. A harmless, simple story, and yet one that had a deep effect and was widely recounted at the time. People felt their soul strengthened by the sustaining power of faith and lived in the aura of this feeling. It would not, in fact, have been possible for this power of faith to become so strong if Europe had not become increasingly isolated through the centuries. Money had drained away toward the Orient, and trade had gradually ceased in consequence. For a certain period, Europe was largely restricted to its agricultural produce, and it is a highly significant factor in Europe's development at this period that a third of the land passed to those who sustained this power of faith. A third of all land was held by the Church. It is as if all that lived in the fourth post-Atlantean epoch and had simply been interrupted by the Roman element was now compressed into this power of faith. But as the power of faith consolidated and rigidified, progress in real Christ consciousness was lost. We should not forget that a really elevated knowledge of Christ existed in the early Christian centuries, in those who were able to place the Christ figure, the being of Christ, into the whole compass of the world of spirit and its powers. Those who were first seized by the grandeur of the figure of Christ were able to look up into worlds of spirit, and, as it were, perceive this figure approaching the earth for eons from spirit worlds, thus connecting the events of Golgotha with everything at work in the cosmos. Those who could interpret the events of Golgotha were powerfully moved by the fact that what was happening on earth was the influx of an event descending from worlds of great cosmic compass. I am very aware that things are presented differently today, but when theologians say that we should return to simple, humble views of Christ Jesus from the early Christian centuries, they cling merely to their own predilections and seek to conceal the majesty of the idea of Christ and the profound insight into the mystery of Golgotha living in people then. Their preferred way of seeing things is to accentuate this supposed simplicity, in which Christ Jesus was nothing more, they like to think, than the, quote, simple man of Nazareth, close quote. It is perhaps less surprising to find such views amongst younger people. The older generation ought to know, though, that a significant change has occurred with respect to such things in our time. I have often heard people saying that what spiritual science presents is almost incomprehensible. And yet only 30 years back, simple country folk would have understood these things easily. Things have changed over the last few decades, but an older generation might still recall how farmers, people in rural communities, still read and absorbed books by people like Jakob Boehme or Eckartshausen. Texts which make great efforts to enter into detailed aspects of the world of spirit. Our cultural life became much more superficial with the rise of the middle classes, who prefer to say that truth should be simple, meaning only that everyone ought to be able to grasp it easily, without thinking too much. Nowadays, there is little evidence left to show, even in humble hearts, that it was possible, in the early Christian centuries, to speak of lofty spiritual matters when one spoke of Christ Jesus, and that ordinary simple people could understand this. This means, therefore, that in subsequent centuries, knowledge of Christ was in a sense covered over, concealed again from humanity, to prevent people getting too close to this knowledge. In such matters, as opposed to our own imaginings, we need to look the truth squarely in the face. One of the deepest needs of our time is to learn to perceive truth and reality once more. I often recall the following instance because it is so vivid and tangible. On one occasion, I was giving a lecture in Colmar on Christianity and wisdom, and two Catholic priests were present. Naturally, they had never heard such things as I was speaking of. And they came to me afterward because of the novelty of the lecture for them, which played a part too, and the fact that they thought what I was trying was not at all bad. Excuse me, what I was saying was not at all bad. If one of their superiors had told them what to think about it beforehand, no doubt they would have considered it all nonsense. They only had one objection to what I had said. Quote, "All you say is very fine," they told me. "It is a fine thing to speak about the spiritual world, but human beings don't understand this at all. We speak to people in a way that they can understand." Close quote. I replied that it was not for them, or for me, to decide how to speak to humankind in line with our predilections. If our speech were governed by these predilections, we would, of course, all think that our own way of putting things was the right one. But that was not the point, I said. Instead, we should speak as our times oblige us to, not answering questions according to our preferred way of seeing the world, but allowing reality itself to answer them. I continued my reply to them by asking if they were really speaking to all people. Quote, "Not all people enter your church," I said, "and many stay away. and that, in fact, is reality's answer. I'm speaking to those who stay away from the church, who also have a right to find their way to Christ Jesus." Close quote. Thus one does not ask oneself what should be said, but tries to ask reality, ask the age we live in. The answers we give ourselves are things we already know and seem very self-evident. It is less easy to learn to understand the obligations imposed on us by the nature of our times. You will have to ponder a good deal to see what really underlies what I have now said. What humanity needs today is to become objective, to learn to live more intimately with our surroundings. If we can understand what this means and take up the corresponding impulse, we will also come to recognize the truth of how, due to events during the centuries I have spoken of, higher knowledge gradually faded in Europe, so that people no longer perceived the spiritual connection between the mystery of Golgotha and cosmic occurrences. Christ faded from European sensibilities and became confined to things people were able or wanted to grasp. But what matters is to grasp reality rather than to grasp what one wishes to. Nowadays, one often hears people saying that we should seek God within us and will find him there. Inwardly, we should unite with our divine self in order to find God. People take offense, especially at the emphasis of spiritual science, on the existence of hierarchies we discover when we depart or emerge from this physical world we live in here, and at the idea that just as we find a wealth of physical phenomena here, so there we likewise find a richly complex world of spirit. People find it much more comfortable to turn directly to their own Christ within. But what do they actually find when they think they have an inner relationship to their God? What they call God is in fact often nothing other than the most immediate spirit being of the hierarchy of the Angeloi, their own guardian angel, whom they then worship as the highest divinity. Our belief that we have found God is not what matters, but instead we should truly understand the reality of this inner experience. In believing that they are inwardly imbued with the divine, people are in fact mostly only imbued with a being from the hierarchy of the Angeloi, or otherwise by their own capital I, as it existed between their previous death and latest birth, living in the world of spirit before it united with their present physical body. There is an important word whose origin, very interestingly, is unknown. Etymological dictionaries can provide all sorts of fascinating derivations for most words, but not for this one, the word God. Have a look in a German dictionary. This is the word whose origins philologists are most uncertain about. This is very significant, very characteristic. You see, what people are actually talking about when they speak of their God is either their own angel being, or even their own self as it existed between death and their latest birth. What they experience, and I'm thinking here of those who are honest and authentic in their capacity to experience, is a reality. Reality is the important thing, and not the illusions to which people succumb that say they are worshipping one God. All they are referring to with this word is an experience of their angel, or even in a sense just their own self, either before or during its incarnation. Spiritual science must investigate what underlies people's supposed experience of God, and many people oppose it precisely because they sense this. The whole of history, from the 3rd to the 10th centuries, and in fact really through to the 15th, aims to cover up the mysteries of Christ Jesus, to conceal them more than to reveal them. This is not critique, but merely characterization. You see, if we are incapable of contemplating an objective account of things, We will never understand the powers governing developments at the beginning of the 15th century, the age of the consciousness soul. One can say that this age is heralded by blasts of thunder, and everything in the world of spirit tends toward the emergence of this consciousness soul with its two poles, both materialistic and spiritual. And it is from this perspective that we must view historical developments. We must invoke such pictures as these, from a strengthened and consolidated power of faith, appearing to us in its highest form in St. Bernard, issues the European tendency, or inclination, to replace Rome with Jerusalem, to found an anti-Roman Christianity centered in Jerusalem. This really underlies the Crusades. Gottfried von Bouillon is not an emissary of the Roman popes, but the figure who takes up the cause of the Crusades in order to erect a bulwark against Rome in Jerusalem and make Christianity independent of Rome. This idea was one that prevailed really for many centuries. Henry II, the Holy Roman Emperor, then gave this the form of an Ecclesia Cattolica Non Romana, non-Roman Catholicism. And thus we see that the European power of faith sends its emanation into the regions into which the Romans dispatched their gold. The Crusaders clash with gold and its consequences in the Orient. Roman gold on the one hand and Oriental gnosis on the other. One has to consider the emanation, the aura surrounding the Crusades, which issues entirely from the European power of faith. That is one coloring of the picture. But let us add to this nuance, and we could paint it, if we wished, simply as color tone, the other picture of the dawning age of the consciousness soul. How would we have to do this? By depicting the figure of Dandolo of Venice. Born in 1108, the Doge of Venice went to Constantinople and was there blinded by the Byzantines. Yet he was an incarnation of the spirit of Ahriman, and despite being unable to see, became Lord of Venice, the same Venice that infused the spirit of Ahriman into the world I just described above. It is an important moment of world history when this Doge Dandolo conquers Constantinople and modifies the original spirit of the Crusades into its subsequent coloring. How did this happen? You see, initially, the Crusaders set out for the Orient to find what sacred relics still remained for the power of faith to light upon. This is what they sought, wishing to bring it back with them to Europe and pay homage to it. They wished to create a real bond between their power of faith and the actual events of the mystery of Golgotha. And when Venice intervened, what became of the sacred relics? They were all collected up and formed the basis for capital gain, for the accumulation of wealth. Under the influence of Venice, these relics gradually became something like stocks and shares whose value kept on increasing. The era of capitalism began to spread through Dandolo, an incarnation of the Ahrimanic spirit. How did Venice succeed in reversing what had already occurred? It drew trade back from the Orient to Europe, rekindling the commercial life that could not have existed previously. And now we have to ask how Venice could grow so powerful commercially since Europe basically was so impoverished. This resurgence in trade involved exchange. Basically, during the early part of the period I have been describing today, Europe was shut off from the Orient, to which it had first given its metal coinage. Without coins, barter and exchange took place. We should repeatedly emphasize the historical fact of how Venice proceeded here. There is evidence of a large sale of Venice to Alexandria and Damietta as the means of exchange to procure Oriental goods in turn. What goods did Venice sell? Some aspects of this can easily be proven by documents, and much else could then be related to it as the basis for further research. In fact, 1,000 people were sold by Venice. Human beings were used to initiate trade with the Orient again. People were sold to the Orient. If you follow this up, you discover something remarkable, to which ordinary history gives little attention. That the most important of the warriors used by Asia to undertake its great and successful European campaigns were the descendants of these people sold as a commodity. The core troops of Asian armies that later invaded Europe were descended from Venetians and people from other Italian cities who had been sold to the Orient. We really ought to look behind the scenes of world history, rather than adhering to the legends so often purported to be history, which are more in the nature of old wives' tales, even if historians of the status of Ranke proffer these legends. Our times are far too serious to avoid looking squarely at the truth. The most important thing to be learned from such truths is to avoid sleepwalking through current events, but instead to follow them with alert attention. Something of huge proportions and ramifications is happening today, but people fail to see it, do not wish to see it, wish instead to see everything in a confused and distorted way. If one hints merely at deeper aspects of human evolution and history, one is immediately dismissed with phrases found everywhere today in superficial newspaper articles, as far removed as possible from reality and productive truth. Today I have endeavored to draw your attention to some outward realities connected with the era in the 15th century, when a transition occurred from the mind-soul to the consciousness-soul. It would be very good indeed if people could integrate such things and reflect upon them. And this is something we need today in all areas. Nowadays, people talk a great deal about how society, the structure of society, needs to develop in the future. Today I read something by someone who thinks himself very clever, or at least believes he has grasped a basic truth of economics. The profound truth he comes up with in the middle of his article is that we should regard society, social coexistence, as an organism. People consider it highly significant if they reject the idea of social mechanisms and replace this with the social organism. And yet, this is the worst Wilsonism. I have often reiterated that the essence of Wilsonism is to see society in terms of an organism only. But to understand social structure, we need more than this concept. We need higher concepts, for social structure can never be regarded merely as an organism. It has to be understood as psychism, pneumatism, for spirit is also at work in all human coexistence. Our age has only impoverished concepts. We cannot establish a national economy without immersing ourselves in spirit knowledge, for it is only by this means that we can discover the meta-organism that surpasses merely organic life. Nowadays everywhere, we find that people lack goodwill to penetrate the spirit. Yet this is needed, and without it there will be unforeseeable consequences. In the 17th century, as I have mentioned before, for example in the last issue of the journal Das Reich, Johann Valentin Andrea wrote The Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosenkreuz. This contains a great many of the impulses connected with the radical change that occurred in the 15th century. In fact, the story is set in the 15th century too. It is very interesting to note that Johann Valentin Andrea wrote this story when he was 17, a 17-year-old boy with an apparently immature intellect, and later on he rejected this story himself. The pietistic theologian Andrea, writing later, himself opposes everything he had earlier written in his Chemical Wedding. This is very interesting indeed. The life of Andrea shows us that he had not the least understanding of what he himself wrote in The Chemical Wedding. the worlds of spirit, wished to reveal something to humanity that was connected with the whole sensibility of that era. Recently I found myself in a castle in Central Europe that has a chapel with symbols embodying this radical change at the start of the new era. There are some fairly primitive paintings on the walls of the staircase, but what do they depict? The chemical wedding of Christian Rosenkreutz. One passes through this chemical wedding to arrive at a Grail chapel. Then the 30 Years' War began after the chemical wedding had been written down, and what had been intended by it was submerged in the tumult of this war. This should teach us something, for it ought not to happen a second time. The spiritual development required of humanity since the 15th century must gradually come about, and next time we will speak of this from a more inward perspective. The end of Lecture 18.